Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Tuesday, April 28th, 2020. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio north of New York City. Taylor Schwenk is working from his home studio in Connecticut. And I got to tell you, Taylor, I have gotten into a routine now. Every morning, crack of dawn, which is where I am, the light really starts to show about 5:50. I am outside looking for dandelions. I am in a dandelion war right now.
This is craziness. I knew that you were, you know, an enthusiast about your lawn, but this dandelion obsession has really ratcheted up over the last couple of days.
Well, we got nothing else to do, right? We're like home. And I told friends, I'm like, when we first had the lockdown, I'm like, I'm going to have a really good lawn. And now if I see a twig or I'm all over it. And our lawn looks like something you could transport. I think I said this the other day. I could transport down to the Masters. The way that my lawn's shaping up early this spring. I'm very excited about it.
You're talking a big game there. I got a question for you just to get an idea in my own mind how big your lawn is. How long does it take to mow? I'm assuming you have a riding lawn mower.
Yeah, parts of it we got to do with a push mower, which is great to have free labor. My 15-year-old.
Of course. Yeah.
It's going to be 2.5 hours.
Okay.
We have 2 acres and, you know, a lot of that is lawn. So it takes some time, and it takes some time every day to be out there attacking the dandelions.
I trust you're doing a great job.
I'm trying to get better at it. Today, as we continue through Contributors Week, we'll be talking with longtime umpire Joe West, who is closing in on a record for most games umpire. Joe has a lot of stories about catchers who are the best advocates. That time he was invited to join a group of gun-toting ball players. And the time he was really, really annoyed with me. We'll also hear today from Hembo and from Tim Kirchin, and there are bits of optimism about baseball returning this year. We'll go over that. First, North Texas has more to offer than just the Rangers' new ballpark should MLB decide to start the pandemic-delayed 2020 baseball season with teams grouped together in different regions. Among the different plans being looked at by Major League Baseball is to use Texas as a mid-American hub, and Rangers general manager John Daniels spoke about that, saying, depending upon a variety of other factors, it makes a lot of sense, just given the nature of the market, the proximity of a lot of facilities, the quality of the facilities, the quality of not just baseball facilities, but the hotels in the area and other things that you need. That from an Associated Press story posted on ESPN.com. Now, before we get to Joe West and Hembo, if you're looking for post-NFL draft talk, check out the Adam Schefter podcast. He's obviously going to talk about what went down over the weekend with Daniel Jeremiah and Mel Kiper Jr., but he's also going to talk to Bill Belichick's girlfriend, Linda Holiday, about Bill's bare-bones draft setup in their home and their dog, who could arguably be declared the winner of the draft. Got a lot of publicity, that's for sure. Find it wherever you get your podcast. Joe West umpired in the big leagues for the first time in 1976. He joined the National League crew in 1978. The record for most games umpired is held by Hall of Famer Bill Clemp, 5,375. Joe West has umpired 5,310 games, and he joined us now. Joe, thanks for joining us and helping to distract us during this downtime.
Well, I'm not trying to distract you. I mean, I don't know why I should ever even talk to you after that night in Chicago.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'll you go, need to tell everybody what happened there.
Yeah, so May 7th, 2017, we had a Sunday night baseball game in Wrigley Field. The Yankees were in Wrigley Field to play the Cubs. And as part of my job, I cue first pitch for Sunday night baseball. And as part of my job, I go with our producer, Andy Reichwald, and meet with the umpires before the game. And we did that before this game, for which Joe had home plate. And in our conversation, I said something along the lines of, Joe, forgive me, I can't remember the exact words. Yeah, it looks like a beautiful night. Two fast pitchers. We'll get this one in quickly. And you shot me a look like, what? Are you kidding that you said that and you jinxed it? Well, that night, the game lasted 18 innings, 6 hours and 5 minutes, 583 pitches, 48 strikeouts. And by the way, the weather in the first pitch listed at 43 degrees, but you know that by the end of the game, it was about 33, 34 degrees. and you were out there behind home plate the whole time, and I'm guessing you were cussing my name.
Oh, yeah. We talked bad about you for about a week.
Yeah, the next time we were
we were thinking about barring you from ever coming to our locker room again.
I remember the next time I had you for a Sunday night game, I went in there and a couple of you, the other umpires said, yeah, watch out. Joe is looking to have you arrested tonight. That night for you, I mean, to be out there for that long, what is that like for an umpire?
Well, it's miserable because you don't realize you're standing up the whole time. The average person is sitting down watching the game, and the players sit down half the game. You got to stand the whole time. And I think the big part is when it goes extra innings, the game is magnified again. So you have to wait longer. You want to be sure every pitch you call is right. So there's more pressure on it when it goes extra innings than it is a normal nine inning game, because after the ninth inning, they're looking for somebody to blame, and that's just the American way. So you don't want it to be yourself or one of the other umpires. So it's more difficult when you go in the extra innings. So
Joe, what was that like after the game? I mean, first off, do you have any stories that you remember from that game? Conversations with catchers as they're coming out, because I'm sure they probably were just like you, like, oh my God, how long is this going to go on?
Yeah, I remember Joe Maddon made a couple comments between innings. It was a miserable game. It was cold and windy, and that's why I don't think they scored a lot of runs, is because the hitters, you know, when they hit the ball on the handle, it stung, and they weren't swinging at good pitches. And I don't think I've ever seen Aaron Judge look that bad as he did that night. And I mean, it was just one of those things where nobody hit. That's why it went forever. But that happens, you know. Every now and then you get a well-pitched game, and I remember Tom Browning had a game in Philadelphia one night, and the game was over in an hour and 54 minutes. And we're walking to the elevator, and the old Philadelphia sports writer, Conlon, he says, it was almost a perfect game. I said, it was a perfect game. It was an hour and 54 minutes. What are you talking about?
I was going to say that, you know, if I go out and I weed for an hour, the next day I got sore hamstrings. The day after a game like that, how is it for you?
You know, once the season gets going, we're okay. It's the first couple of spring training play jobs that really get you, because you haven't squatted 350 times all winter. I mean, you might do some exercises and stuff, but you're not getting in position for a pitch like you do in a spring training game. But after the first two or three spring training games, you're pretty much set to go. You, of course, 18 innings, you're a lot tireder than you'd normally be, but I don't think it has any reflection on your legs. I remember my knee surgeon that has operated on both my knees, and he keeps telling me I need knee replacement. He says, you'd be better off working a plate every day, because then you wouldn't have this starting and stopping on the bases. He says, you think that they'd let you work home plate every day? I said, I don't think the players like that. he kind of chuckled and laughed. He's the orthopedic surgeon for the Marlins. His son was Danny Cannell, the quarterback of Florida State, and he was my knee surgeon. So, but it's kind of funny. You go back and look on all these things, and you look at the things that have happened over the years. And I remember I've been here for six commissioners. I can remember when the Braves were bought by Ted Turner. And Ted Turner used to, when he'd sit in that box seat by the Braves dugout in old Fulton County Stadium, when his player would hit a home run, he'd jump out of his box seat, run the home plate, and shake his hand. And Tom Gorman was my first crew chief, and Tom told him the second time, he did, if you keep doing that, I'm going to have to kick you out of the game. And Ted looked at him and said, if you do, I'll turn the lights off. So, but... I mean, we've had some real characters of the game here, and Ted Turner was just one. You and I were talking earlier about the book Lords of the Realm. I think Ted in that book said we have the only legal monopoly in America, and we're screwing it up. So, but you go back, and I have a story for just about every commissioner. Some of them are cute, some of them are just matter of fact, but you go back and look at all the times that I've worked games, and and all the people I've seen. You know, I've worked with over 150 different umpires.
Wow.
I've been on the field with 50 or more than 50 Hall of Famers. Some of them were managers. Some of them were players. Two of them were umpires. And they're all, and there should be a lot more umpires than that in the Hall of Fame. But what I'm getting at is I've been here. This will be my 43rd year. And some of the things that you see and do, one of the other statistics I should give you is that I've worked in 51 different stadiums for major league games.
Jeez.
I mean, regular season major league games. I worked in Tokyo. I worked in Omaha last year. I mean, for a major league game, you can't work in 51 stadiums. They're not enough. You know what I mean? And one of my funniest stories about that is when the Rockies had just become a new franchise and they were going to move from Mile High Stadium to Coors Field. And Bob Gephardt was the general manager there. And he came out of the locker room and he says, you know, we did everything right. We had the handicap section so they could all park in the players' parking lot and we could push the wheelchairs right up to the left field fence. And that way, we didn't have to have specialty ramps and specialty things for the handicap. And they are all happy because they get to sit on the field level. It's almost better than a box seat. It just happens to be in left field. And he said, and everything was going great till one of our guys hit a home run and 13 people got up out of wheelchairs and ran for the ball.
Oh, jeez. Oh, man. So I mentioned you are now just 59 games away from Bill Clem for number one all time in games umpired. Joe, what's that going to mean to you? I mean, what will that represent for you?
Well, it's a long time coming, and I didn't really think about it till a couple of years ago. And Eddie Montague mentioned something about it when I passed an old American League umpire, Tom Connolly, and he said you should go for the record. And so I kind of set my sights on trying to be healthy enough to get there. And it's been fun. Like I said, I've worked with over 150 different umpires, and I mean, it's been a good run, and it's opened a lot of doors for me. I've shaken hands with a bunch of presidents. I've worked for six different commissioners, and each one of them was different from the next one. I didn't work in the American League until the 2000s because you didn't work in our league like that. So I was really a National League umpire for the first 22 years of the 40 some years. But it was interesting. In fact, I got a little card in the mail the other day from a Minnesota Twins fan, and they said, what was it like with Rod Carew and Tony Oliva? And I had to write back. I never had them in a game so because they were already retired
right
by the time we started working both leagues. And it's kind of funny, you know, years ago, and you and I have talked about this before, I started this music stuff where I was recording and writing songs and everything. And I met a good friend of yours, Richard Sturban, with the Oak Ridge Boys, and he said to tell you hello. So, he did remember you, even though you were a snot-nosed kid at the time, but he did remember you. So, and Mickey Gilley's a good friend of mine. Johnny Lee's a good friend of mine. Gene Watson's a good friend of mine. Haggard, before he passed, I used to talk to him a lot. The uniqueness of this job, it just opens a lot of doors. And I've been, you know, I sang on the Grand Ole Opry with the Hee Haw Band. And I think I told you this story about Torrey Lavella's father, you know. So that's a long story, so we probably don't have time to even talk about that one. But his dad used to produce all the Hee Haws that were on television. And I've been really lucky. So. That record is something that should be shared by all those people that I work with, and I'm happy to say that they've all meant a lot to me along the way.
And that'll be a special day among the president. You mentioned meeting presidents. What was an interaction with a president that'll stick with you?
Oh well, I think my favorite was old George Bush, the first George Bush. his he used to sit right behind the plate in Houston. And Dutch Rennert was on the crew that year, and he was retiring. And so I had gone to this hat company in St. Louis and taken one of Dutch's umpire's hats. And I had put the oak leaves on the bill like an admiral's hat. So it would be something he could retire with, play golf with and everything. And it'd be a one-of-a-kind hat. Well, I had the guy do the same thing for one of my hats so that I'd have one at home to play golf with in the winter, right? So we walked on the field that the first night we were in Houston. I had already given Dutch his hat, and mine was still in my locker. And we walked on the field. There's George and Barbara Bush sitting right behind home plate. So I said, wait a minute, boys, I'll be right back. And I went back to the locker room. I got that hat because I knew it would fit him because Gus Miller in Cincinnati made cowboy hats for the Bushes. And I knew that George Bush wore the same size hat that I wore. So it fit him perfect. I came back and I handed it to him, and he put it on right away. And Barb was just beamed. She thought that was the coolest thing in the world. And Gary Darling, who was working home plate, he said, now, if I get in trouble, I'm going to turn back around here and ask you for help. He says, oh, no. Kind of pawned it off. But, you know, it was good. He was quite the fan, and he loved the Astros.
A big baseball fan and played at Yale. You know, according to him, he was no-hit, all-field first baseman. He was a big baseball fan.
Oh, yeah.
What was the craziest game you were ever a part of in your mind?
The craziest.
A loud crowd some situation that happened or something that when you think back on it, you think back, boy, that was an absolutely insane game.
Well, I think one of the most intense games I was ever in was the one, the playoff game between Boston and New York, where Alex Rodriguez slapped at the glove with a pitcher, Arroyo.
Yep.
And he knocked it out of his hands. And we, you know, of course, when the ball got free, the first base umpire, Randy Marsh, had about five people running at him. He didn't see that Alex slapped at the glove. He just saw the ball on the ground. So he signaled safe. And when he signaled safe, now we can't change it. He's got to ask us. So we've got to get close enough to him to understand that we saw something that he didn't. And we did. In fact, when Francona came out to argue, I told him, just stay right here. Don't move. Just stay here. And so we went. We got where Randy could see that something was wrong. And he came to us and he said, what happened? I said, well, he slapped the glove with his bare hand. He can't do that. It's interference. And the right field umpire was Jeff Kellogg. He said, that's exactly what happened. And of course, we got the whole crew together and we changed it. And when we changed it, they threw everything in the world at us. And in fact, just before Randy called Alex out, I told him, I said, you know, when we change this, they're going to throw everything in the world. He said, I know. So he calls him out. Now Jeter, who had scored, has to go back to first base. And so that took a run off the board, and the Yankee fans threw everything in the world at us. Some guy threw his BMW keys at John Hirschbeck at third base.
You're kidding.
I told him we should go through the parking lot and see if we could find his car keys. And we actually had to go get the riot squad to come out on the field to calm everything down. And this was the playoffs, and I want to say, was it 94?
Yeah, 2004. Yeah. They were down 3-0, and then game 6 and 7 in Yankee Stadium, the Red Sox win. And that was one of the calls that happened in two games.
That was game 6.
Yep.
And it was intense, but as soon as the police came out, they arrested like 15 or 16 people, and then it was over. I mean, they were still yelling at us when the game ended. But the point is, the next day, when we walked out for the lineup cards, we actually got a small ovation from the fans because they knew we called it right, and it went against their home team. So that's probably the most interesting or unusual thing that I've ever witnessed is getting an ovation after we called something against the team. You know what I mean?
But oh, yeah.
It was an unbelievable thing. Yeah, and I can't tell you how good it felt when the media took our side. The media said they were absolutely right. And, you know, and of course, usually when an umpire's noticed, he's noticed because he made a mistake. And And that's a sad thing. All the good calls the guy makes, and then he misses one, and then I mean he's a dog for the rest of the day. But anyway, I mean that's just part of the job. You know, you got to do the very best you can, and that's all you can do.
I wanted to one of the things that I've always loved in watching baseball is the interaction between the catcher, the hitter, the pitcher, and the umpire, home plate umpire. And so I wanted to ask you, who was really good at advocating for, you know, their case? First off, among catchers, does anybody pop to mind that the way they did it? Because in my time covering baseball, I've enjoyed, you know, the conversations with guys like David Ross, you know, Jason Varitek, Joe Girardi. And just say, how do you do that? Like, how do you make your case? Because they're the ones advocating for their pitcher. Among catchers, who jumps to mind?
Well, Gary Carter never shut up.
Really?
he was talking the whole time. But he had two different strike zones, one when he was catching and one when he was hitting. but he talked the whole game. And Bench was completely different. He would just sit right behind the middle of the plate. But I didn't realize this until first couple of years I was in late. Bench couldn't move. He couldn't move inside because he'd be blocking you from everything. And he couldn't move outside because the pitchers that he handled weren't that good. He was just trying to get them to throw the ball over the plate. It's the only team you've ever seen in the world could win 100 games with no pitching with the Reds back then. And he would never say anything until it would just be the right time. He had perfect timing. This guy started yelling at me in Houston one day at the Astrodome, and he yelled for the first six innings. And in the seventh inning, he lost his voice. And Bench called timeout and turned around and says, "You got him. You finally got him."
Oh, my. Who was a hitter who was really good at advocating, that you appreciated the way that he would advocate for himself?
You know who, and I only know this because he told me, was Reggie Jackson. He would say, "Now is not the time to call that ball off the plate," or he said, "This is the wrong time of day to call that." But I never had Reggie. He was in the American League when I was coming up those first 20 some years. But there's a couple, you know. Scott Rowland was funny one day. He says, I called a pitch that might have been a little high on him. He says, "Are you okay now?" And Steve Garvey one day said the same thing. He said, "Are we ready now?" But I mean, little remarks like that. Man, I mean, and you have to laugh, you know. So, I mean, you can only do the best you can.
What about a pitcher who you appreciated the nature of how they would express their opinions?
Well, the great pitchers didn't say anything. In fact, Steve Carlton used to yell at McCarver if McCarver would say anything.
Really?
He said, "You just catch. They'll umpire." Carlton wouldn't let McCarver say anything to the umpires. And one of the funny stories about McCarver was the Gibson story, where he went to the mound to talk to Gibson between hitters, and Gibson told him, "You need to get back behind the plate. The only thing you know about pitching is you can't hit it." and McCarver was a good baseball guy. He played the game hard. He knew the game. I mean, like Gibson said, he wasn't a very good hitter, but I mean, he was a good catcher to work by. He was a little grumpier than most, but you know, but that's okay, you know. And I had Jerry Grody. I thought Jerry Grody was one of the greatest catchers I ever saw, and a lot of guys just hated him because of his demeanor. But I thought he was a great catcher. But the pitchers, it's amazing. I'm lucky. I saw Seaver, who might have been the best pitcher I've ever seen. I saw Randy Johnson when he was wild, and I saw him when he got his control. And I thought the year that he pitched in Houston was the best I'd ever seen any left-hander pitch. I had Carlton at the end of his career. He wasn't what he was I mean, I had him in his later years, but he was a great pitcher then. I had Fernando Valenzuela. Now, that was a character. I mean, he didn't throw anything straight. Not anything. And Greg Maddux, how can you question what he was like? I mean, we had him one day in St. Louis, and he threw strike three past Vince Coleman, and Coleman turned around and yelled at the umpire. And Greg says, he didn't strike you out. I did. If you want another one, get back up there. And now the bench is empty. We got a brawl on the field.
Oh.
But, yeah, you know, I've been lucky. I've seen a lot of the best players that have ever played the game. And old Ken Griffey Jr., I had his dad. And his dad was just the happy-go-lucky guy, always smiling. And Ken Griffey, every time he'd run by me, he'd say, throw me out of the game. I'm ready to get out of here. Throw me out of the game. And we never would throw him out of the game, you know. But it's funny. I mean, I've worked with father and sons. I worked with Tom Gorman and Brian Gorman. Tom Gorman was my first crew chief, and I was Brian Gorman's first crew chief. I worked with Paul Runge and his son, Brian Runge. The Wendelstedts, Harry and Hunter. I've been here. I think I've been here since Moby Dick was a guppy. So.
Along those lines, on the ejections, you mentioned you, you know, you've had fathers and sons. You ejected Bob Boone and Aaron Boone. And then there was this, and my last question for you, there was a note on this ejection, and I asked because I know this person, Jose Cardenal, was a coach with the Yankees when I covered the Yankees, and I know his sense of humor. And the note was is that October 3rd, 1993, last day of the season, I'm sure, you know, getaway day. And according to the note, Jose Cardenal asked you to eject him because he had to catch a plane.
Oh, that's what he told the media. That's not what he said.
Okay.
But if that's his story, he can stick to it. That's okay.
All right. Who had the most creative?
That's not what happened.
Oh, what happened then?
No. He used some language that was inappropriate, but that's okay.
Okay.
But you're about to say something about the craziest guy. You know, Earl Weaver never finished the game.
Well, who was?
And he was in it. He was in the American League. I got him twice in spring training.
I was going to say, Earl Weaver, there are those great clips of him from the 1970s. And he just – look, when I know the managers from my conversations with him, and sometimes when they go out there, you know they're putting on a show. It felt like with Earl Weaver, there was no show. That was Earl.
Oh, yeah. And yet you put him on the golf course, he was the most polite person in the world. Until you said something about his height, because we're playing one day and they were arguing over, is that put good? Is that not good? Is that? And Johnny Lobenzina said, if it's within your height, Earl, it's good. And he blew a gasket. He got really mad at Johnny. But anyway.
All right. These are great stories.
And you know what?
I always love you.
Ryan Klesko was invited to a golf tournament that I was sponsoring at Doral. So when he got there, there was all these country music artists and everything, and he was like a little kid in a candy store. So after the season ended, that year, he invited me to go pheasant hunting. Now, I don't know how he got my phone number. Evidently, he got it from somebody from the golf tournament. He says, I want to take you pheasant hunting. I said, well, that's great. I've never been pheasant hunting. I've been duck hunting, goose hunting, bear hunting, deer hunting, but I've never been pheasant hunting. He says, yeah, there's about 12 of us going to go out on this ranch that I have outside of Atlanta. I said, really? He said, what 12? He named off 12 major league ball players. I said, let me get this straight. You want me to walk out in the open field with 12 ball players with shotguns? I said, have you lost your mind?
Oh, that's great. All right, Joe. Well, I appreciate your time and helping to distract us.
Okay. Well, I'm glad I distracted you just a little bit. You take care. We'll see you soon.
Jumping into the numbers.
After evaluating millions of pieces of data in the blink of an eye, the winner is Cincinnati by 200 points. Why, you worthless hunk of junk.
This is Hembo Knows.
And Hembo is Paul M. McKeady. He's a researcher for ESPN who is a tells us he's the head honcho on the show. Get up. We have not actually confirmed that. So Hembo, I had a lot of fun listening to Joe West's stories. I always love his stories. That one about being invited on a hunting trip, by Ryan Klesko, and his response about being in the mix of a lot of ball players with guns, that got a laugh out of me.
Me too. And the first thought that I had, Buster, was if it just so happens that Joe West and Madison Bumgarner would have gone on this trip, I can say with certainty that only one of the two of them would have come back. And that is because, obviously, well, I mean, look, I hearken back to, you know, their epic stare down. But, you know, the idea of them both having a shotgun on a trip, you know, hunting whatever it might be, probably not the safest thing in the world.
Oh, only if, you know, all we just left to our imagination. We were talking yesterday about how imagine Satchel Paige on social media and imagine a hunting trip with Madison Bumgarner and Joe West. That would be something.
I mean, I'm not sure any of those guys would have been on social media during that time. They're certainly not the type. But that was the first thought that I had. And I have to say, before we move on, Buster, the Joe West, I think, are likely to become extinct. And one of the reasons why I'm so against the implementation of the electronic strike zone is in part because of the charm of the game in which the umpires possess. Like, I think that's something that we'll probably miss a lot. The interaction between umpire and manager, between umpire and player. And over the course of baseball history, some of our best moments involve the umpires. I know we argue that, you know, the best ones are the ones that you don't know that they're there. But baseball's history is so rich and deep. And I think that the umpires and the interaction they have between the players and the managers is something so rich and so ingrained that I would hate to see it go.
Yeah. That way, and I agree with you. A lot of it will go away once you have electronic umpires. Later in the week, we expect to have Bill James as we go through our Contributors Week. And by the way, we'll be also be talking with Jana Marie Smith, who designed Camden Yards and started a new wave of ballparks. But I know, Hembo, you have some thoughts on Bill James.
Well, I'm of the opinion, Buster, that no person over the last, say, 30 years has had a bigger impact on the way the game of baseball is played than Bill James. Though he never played and though he was never more than an advisor within an organization, his statistical work, Buster, was years, in some cases decades, ahead of his time. And I don't think that it is hyperbole to say that his work brought baseball out of the Stone Ages and introduced, in some sense, all sports to math in a way that had been previously unimaginable. And I guess because of that, I believe that Bill James is one who should be elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame and inducted during his lifetime.
I 100% agree with you, and I hope that happens here in the next few years, because there's no doubt he changed the sport dramatically with his research. When I graduated from high school, the present that I got from my parents was a Bill James baseball abstract. That was my first introduction to Bill James. I know you you love to read his abstract as well.
I did, Buster, and there are three anecdotes that I'm going to share with you, things that I learned from his abstract that I found to be just totally extraordinary and in some sense revolutionary. The first is one about Willie McCovey, of which he wrote, if he played in the 90s with the DH and the modern parks, he'd hit 800 home runs. James really popularized the notion of park effects and introduced us to context-neutral statistics as a way to standardize performance across eras, and players like Willie McCovey were penalized because of the context of their careers. The second player this is a legendary line. He says, of Ricky Henderson, if you could split them in two, as you know, Buster, you'd have two Hall of Famers. Bill James made that claim citing Henderson's skill as a base dealer, as a power speed threat, as a leadoff hitter, as a run scorer, etc. James was genuinely revolutionary in quantifying a player's value with multiple skills. No one really did it before, and he got it down to a science long before anyone else did. And the last thing I would say about him is I would be curious how he would describe himself, because I would describe Bill James more as a storyteller and less of a statistician. That's certainly how I view myself as one who works with stats. It just so happens that we use numbers instead of words. Although I will say that he's a fairly underrated historian in terms of the context and the anecdotes that you'll sometimes find. And one I found tremendous, and it has a tie-in this week, and it's about Lou Gehrig. Lou Gehrig, as it says in his abstract, decided to end his streak after Joe Gordon and Bill Dickey congratulated him for making a routine play in the infield. And that really struck me, because there are these legendary stories of Joe DiMaggio talking about how, you know, Gehrig would swing and miss 20 times in a row during batting practice and spring training in that year, 1939, and had all these struggles, obviously, leading up to his eventual taking himself out of the lineup. But it was that moment outlined in Bill James' historical abstract that struck me as extraordinarily significant. And this week in 1939, Buster, Gary played his last game at the age of 35.
I agree with you. I think that the most effective analysts are the ones who can put these numbers into human context. I've heard that from players when they say the people from the front office come down and present information to them. A lot of it is about humanizing the numbers, you know, having a story, connecting with players, making them understand how it would change their story. So I agree with you about Bill James 100%. And I really look forward to that conversation. Actually, I've never talked to him in my life. So that'll be a lot of fun.
That'll be a lot of fun.
All right. So on Sunday, I wrote a column basically raising a red flag about this logjam right now between Major League Baseball and the Players Association over compensation. And they cannot restart the season, even if they're cleared, until they get this issue resolved. Because on one hand, Scott Boras, Tony Clark made clear that, you know, they, and I'm going to just paraphrase it, they expect that the players' contract moving forward will be honored based on their salary, with that money prorated based on how many games they play. On the other side, you're going to see owners looking for some salary offsets because it's clear their industry has taken a devastating hit financially, and they're certainly not going to come close to generating the same type of revenue. My general feeling is work it out. You guys better work it out, because God help them if, in fact, they don't come to an agreement at a time when millions and millions of people are losing their jobs and the economy is tanking. And these are people who have access to a lot of money. And it's just a question of actually coming to an agreement over it. But within that column, you wrote in a note to me that you have two things you agree with and two things you disagree with.
I do. The first, Buster, that I really agree with is this line that you mentioned: this disagreement over a pile of money at a time when some hospitals and funeral homes struggle with an overflow of coronavirus victims is an enormous mistake. And the way that you framed that, I think, is perfect, because what it shows is that the general public is not going to be sympathetic with these major corporations, particularly Major League Baseball, and entertainment industry that we know funnels in so much money, nearly $11 billion to be specific. There is no doubt in my mind. Zero sympathy will be provided Major League Baseball or any individual team. The second, this is quoting a source of yours, I'm not sure there's not a lot of trust, speaking of which, between the Major League Baseball and the Players Association. And that is my biggest fear, that in a time like this, we're going to allow a sort of, at this point, frayed or fractured relationship between the two to get in the way of what's right. I think you're absolutely right in saying that that could potentially be an utterly devastating component of this, and that's something that they can't afford to get wrong.
And the two parts of the column you disagree with?
Well, you mentioned, Buster, that you think that baseball could lose a generation of fans potentially if this is sort of if the financial hangup is significant enough, and I don't agree with that. The difference between this and the player strike, in my judgment, and correct me if I'm wrong, you covered that, I didn't, is right now, like, sports fans in this country don't have anywhere to turn. Yes, it would be really, really ugly, and it would be terrible public relations for Major League Baseball. But I don't really think it much matters how we get there. If there's baseball on our televisions this year because of the supply and demand, I think a ton of people are going to watch it, regardless of whether or not they have to grit their teeth to do it. The second part, Buster, that I disagree with you on is the notion that A.J. Hinch and Alex Cora are penalized this year. By, let's say we missed the entire season and they had the opportunity to come back in 2021. I view it very differently than you do. The analogy that I'll use is if somebody is clearly guilty and let's say, you know, declared a mistrial or something to that effect, the public is not going to be sympathetic to that person. If the 1920 baseball season was not played and those eight players got to return in 1921 without really missing any time, I don't think anybody would view that as just. So even though, like, these circumstances are extraordinary, I do think that the public, generally speaking, and people within the game are going to be really upset that those guys ended up not missing time. Maybe you'll think, maybe your opinion is that it was more than a slap on the wrist. It is my opinion that it would not be. Missing considerable time, in my judgment, is really the only penalty that these guys can that you could levy on these people that would be worthwhile. That is my opinion on the matter.
Just to double back on your disagreement about how fans would feel, I'm telling you, I remember 95, how long it took for some teams to get fans to come back to the ballpark, because there were a lot of fans. I meet fans to this day. I'll, you know, introduce myself. Oh yeah, you work for ESPN. I stopped watching baseball after the 95 strike. And, you know, that was just a disagreement. And by the way, the players back in 95 were clearly in the right. That was a labor situation for players and owners not to agree how to split a pile of money, and sports don't happen. That sport doesn't happen because they can't decide, how to split that money at a time when the economy and the nation is devastated. Wow. I can't even imagine what the reaction would be. And it's after that column posted, on Sunday, I got a bunch of texts from people around the game basically saying, amen. That there's a lot at stake here, especially people I heard from who were around in 95, and they were like, it was really bad in 95. It would be times 10, given the current situation with our country.
It's interesting. Like your theory, like your going theory here is that people, hatred essentially, or disdain for that process would usurp people's love for baseball. My opinion would be that baseball, people's love for baseball, would usurp all that, and they would watch the games gritting their teeth because they love the game and they miss the game.
I agree with you. Most would. I think a big chunk of people would basically give baseball the, you know, proverbial hand gesture, and I won't go further than that. Real quick, I heard from a source yesterday. He guesstimated, and there has been in the last 5 or 6 days, as I wrote about on Sunday, this growing sense of optimism that they're going to be able to restart. This source I talked to yesterday gave me an over-under of a date on June 12th, which I feel like is optimistic, way too optimistic. The other thing, too, with all these, you know, predictions and thoughts and bits of optimism that we're hearing, it's all completely, all of it depends on testing and where spots open up and where the hot spots are. What do you think?
I think that you're right. June 12th sounds great, but I don't know that that date is any more accurate than whether or not you know, me or Taylor threw a dart at a, you know, hypothetical calendar. Like I really don't get the sense that, like, I do agree with you. I think it's probably optimistic. The problem with all these guesstimations, Buster, is that in times like these, my tendency and default is to trust the experts. And right now the experts are themselves telling you that they don't know. So right. The idea that any of us do, I think, is really misguided. Like, we are months away from knowing as much as we need to about this virus, in my judgment, and probably even months beyond that in terms of the vaccination and treatment and testing. Like, I think this is like every single day for us feels so long because we're not doing anything, but we've only really covered 7 or 8 weeks here, truly. So like in the grand scheme of these things, that's a fairly insignificant amount of time. So to answer your question, like June 12th sounds great. My guess, I would pound the over.
All right, Hembo, good to talk with you. I'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Yes, sir. Later, boys.
Here's Tim Kirkchin's Daily Baseball Fix about Albert Pujols.
Hi, this is Tim Kirkchin, and on this date in 2001, Albert Pujols set a rookie record for most home runs in April with 8. Mike McFarland, former Royals catcher, owns a batting cage in Kansas City, and he told me in the winter leading up to spring training 2001, he said this big guy came in every single day. He hit all day, he didn't say a word to anyone, and then he left. And he said, Mike said, I looked at him and I said, I have no idea who this guy is, but man, can he hit. So early on in that season, McFarland and I are doing a Cardinals highlight on Baseball Tonight. And Mike grabs my shoulder and says, that's the guy. That's the guy from the batting cage. Well, that guy ended up winning 3 MVPs. He's one of the greatest hitters of all time, one of the greatest first basemen of all time. That guy from the batting cage was Albert Pujols.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Tuesday. Two good friends of the pod here writing in. Portland Maverick at the Battered Bees writes in, who were some guys you loved watching that weren't necessarily superstars? For me, guys like Devon White roaming around the outfield, Paul O'Neill grinding at the plate, and Eric Chavez firing across the diamond were always much must watches. I'm a big Paul O'Neill fan myself. What say you, Buster?
I would agree with that, and I covered him for 4 years. I love covering him because he would be nothing but honest all the time. Like, if he was unhappy with something, that was betrayed in his body language, in his words. If he didn't like some question you asked him, he let you know about it. You know, I remember he's incredibly superstitious when he played, and he hated talking about any numbers, any milestones that he might be approaching statistically. So one time I walked up to him, this was in his last season, and I said, "Hey, Paul, did you hear about the record? Your record?" He goes, "Oh, Buster, I don't like that stuff. Don't talk to me about that." I said, "Paul, no, this is something you've already done." He goes, "Really? What is it?" Like he totally flipped. You know, another guy I've always enjoyed watching. I've always enjoyed watching Todd Frazier play. I mean, he has so much fun. He has an absolute blast. I love watching him interact with other players. And I'm going to miss CC Sabathia because, man, that guy competed when he was on the mound.
Oh, my gosh. I definitely lots of memories of CC, even my limited baseball knowledge here, just being a gamer in big spots.
Oh, yeah.
PK Steinberg at PK Steinberg writes in, "What tool do you use to pull up those nefarious dandelions?"
You know, I looked up the tool, and I do have a special tool, and it's not the regular dandelion remover. It's got one. It's got a little curved wedge of metal that creates some leverage when you pull it up. And I tried to Google it. It costs about $4 to $6. And this is what popped up: hand tool, garden, outdoor removal, stainless steel, farmland puller, dandelion, manual digging lawn, multifunction weeder transplant. I'm not kidding. That's the headline.
Longest name ever.
That's the topper. I know. I don't think it's the longest name. Probably they just put all those words on top of this. So if anyone Googled that's where the page would take them, so they could buy this tool. It's very effective. We have an old fashioned dandelion remover that's not nearly as effective. My son and I, we always race for the one with a little metal wedge to create the leverage.
And you can't get that on any other baseball podcast, I assure you. So continue to subscribe, rate, and review to the podcast wherever you enjoy podcasts.
That's right. And tomorrow I'll be talking John Deere. No, just kidding. That my thanks today to Hembo, to Joe West for all those great stories, and to Taylor Schwenk for producing. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great day and stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.